Hello, I'm Matt Mayton, Deputy Editor of Total Film Magazine, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
This week, we're talking Malcolm and Marie, Greenland, Rams, Bliss, and A Glitch in the Matrix. But first, let's have a quick catch-up on WandaVision now that we've all seen episode 4, which was something of a game-changer for the series. Did you guys like this episode?
Yes, very much so. It got so meta, didn't it? Because you actually had characters in WandaVision watching WandaVision, and the plot, on one hand, it didn't move forward at all, but on the other hand, it leapt forward. So, yeah, it's very clever. I think it would satisfy a lot of people who've been waiting for something to happen, waiting for a big reveal, you know, a few secrets to be unveiled in this very mysterious saga. So, yeah, it was definitely a key episode, and it was great to see people like Randall Park and Kat Dennings, who've obviously been in the MCU before, to see them take centre stage. I thought Kat Dennings in particular was great fun, you know, perhaps even more so than she was in the Thor movies. I thought this was a really good showcase for her.
They had a great relationship, actually, those two. That would be nice to see that expanded upon in sort of future episodes. I mean, I really enjoyed the episode, but I was expecting them to tease it more because the last few we've been getting little teases of this sort of other world that were impinging on Wanda's sort of sitcom world, let's call it. And then suddenly it's like, bang, big reveal. Here's where we're at, which is great. But I kind of thought they were going to string us along a little bit longer.
I felt the same as you, that I was expecting to have to go for like 6 or 7 episodes before we actually saw outside of that sort of bubble. But do you think this means we're in for sort of more surprises? Do you think because they've revealed this so early that that means there's even kind of more explosive stuff awaiting over the next sort of, you know, rest of the season?
Oh, yeah, because we still don't know exactly why everything's based on old sitcoms. What they're accessing Wanda's memories, or is it someone from outside doing this? I mean, why is it all so rooted in television? There's kind of got to be some explanation for that. And I think we're bound to get more MCU guest stars as well. That's got to be on the cards as it nears the finale.
Have you heard of any other possible rumoured cameos? Is there anything that you've heard whisper of?
I have. I don't know if I want to say. Spoilers.
Yes, let's leave it then for the moment. Yeah. But no, it will be nice just to see some familiar faces turning up again.
Teyonah Parris has been great. It was really interesting seeing what happened to Maria Rambo, and that's presumably going to eventually end up tying into Captain Marvel 2 somewhere down the line. I really loved that hospital scene as well, where you saw the kind of, you know, the blip restarting. I just thought that whole thing was really well done, and then with her and her mum, you know, and discovering the time lapse, and then just all these people just appearing in the hospital. I thought that was a really good scene.
All that chaos that must have happened, because we didn't really see that, did it? It was kind of played for laughs in Spider-Man Far From Home, but you think how chaotic that must have been to have all those millions of people suddenly resurrected and literally in a click of the fingers. So I wonder if they will continue to address that maybe in future Marvel projects.
It was strange to have an episode kind of without Wanda and Vision as well. I mean, they're very much in the background. I wonder if that will continue, if there'll be a kind of balance now between the two worlds.
I wonder that, or, you know, we'll find out tomorrow, I guess. Are we just going to go straight into what would it be, 80s now? Are we up to the 80s?
Yeah,
we're just going to get another pure 80s episode,
like Charles in Charge, that kind of classic 80s sitcom.
Cheers, or
Fraser in the 90s. I mean, you know,
Friends, they've got to riff on Friends at some point, or Seinfeld, or hundreds of possibilities.
Plenty to look forward to. So we'll look forward to the new one tomorrow. So now let's talk about the first one of the week, which, like the early episodes of WandaVision, is black and white and set in a single domestic location.
Mystery. The unknown. It's what supports the tension of a relationship.
You're angry.
No. The what if factor.
Marie.
What if there's someone who loved them better?
So that's Malcolm and Marie, which is written and directed by Euphoria creator Sam Levinson, and it stars Zendaya and John David Washington, who are also both producers on the film. And it's about a film director played by John David Washington, and he's returning home after the premiere of his latest film, and he's with his long-term partner Marie, played by Zendaya. And it soon comes out that he didn't thank her when he gave his speech at the premiere, and that's where this kind of two-hander kicks off, and they have a kind of basically an almighty row for the evening. Before we actually review the film ourselves, our Hollywood correspondent Adam Tanswell caught up with Zendaya to talk about Malcolm and Marie.
Can you take us on set and talk about the shooting overnight? How crazy were the hours, and how did you get into that?
Yeah, so when we first got there, we quarantined for about 12 days or something like that. And in that time, we were kind of like in the middle of nowhere, just in our own space, in this bubble that we have created. And during that time, we were able to really workshop the material and literally go through every moment with a fine-tooth comb and discuss and question everything. And from that came a lot of beautiful discussions, which also led to a third act that wasn't quite written yet. and then while we were actually shooting, you know, we had these night shoots, but oddly enough, because I was in quarantine, I had pretty much already become nocturnal. So it felt very natural to shoot this way, to be honest. I was probably the most awake person of all of us. It felt like my normal hours. And it was interesting because we had a very limited amount of time, sundown to sunup, and we had to get what we could. And it was very short nights, I believe, because of it was summertime. So the nights were pretty short. So we were figuring it out, trying to do the best we could to get it done.
And then talk about these epic monologues. How much of a challenge is it to get those words into your head? How do you do it?
You know, I'm lucky in the sense that I've been a part of this from its inception, you know, from literally being like, hey, Sam, can you write something for me? To the first day he started writing, and then he would call, and then we'd discuss it for hours. During that process of calling and talking and hearing him read pages, I would record a lot of it so that I could start memorizing my lines once I knew we got it. That helped, but also just kind of being a part of it from the beginning like that and knowing that a lot of conversations, even from like when we were on Euphoria and like throughout the quarantine and had kind of bled into these two characters, it kind of just felt more natural to come out of my mouth in anyway. So again, when we were on, you know, on location and able to just be in this room and just run it and go through it and figure it out, and like having that workshopping process really, really helped us navigate the actual words. And Sam is also one of those people that, because it's such an open space, I'm not as good as improv as John David is, but he allows us the space. Like if it doesn't work when we're on set, if it's not right, we'll rewrite it. We'll figure it out. Don't worry about it, or change it, or say something else if that doesn't feel right. You know, that was also really helpful.
That must have been freeing in a way as well. Yeah. Did you talk about this sort of developing the chemistry between you and John David Washington? I guess the COVID regulations help with that. I mean, were you able to sort of spend a lot of time in each other's company? How does it work?
We're in this like, you know, this kind of like this little outdoor, you know, kind of camp together, theater camp. And I think that, you know, through all these beautiful discussions that we all, you know, with Sam, myself, Marcel, and John David, we got to be together and have these beautiful discussions about life and love and relationships and our connection to the industry and experiences in the industry. And then that would kind of tangent off into, you know, let's talk about Beyonce and let's talk about this, let's talk about that, you know. That I think was hugely a part of all of us really bonding and like becoming very close. But also I think it's just a credit to like what a lovely person John David is. He's so sweet. He's just such a kind, genuine, good person that it's like, it's very hard not to just absolutely adore him, you know? And I think it's even that much more like jarring when you see him as Malcolm, because it's such a contrast to who he is. Like, I don't know where he had to go to dig that out, but it was really cool to watch.
So that was Zendaya talking about Malcolm and Marie. So Matthew, what did you think of this film?
I liked it a lot. I'd say it's the most involving portrait of a combative couple since Marriage Story. It kind of reminded me very much of that, except with Marriage Story, you obviously had a lot of supporting characters, whereas this is absolutely a two-hander. It's completely focused on these two characters during this very, I guess it's set in real time and this kind of long night.
Pretty much, isn't it? Yeah.
The acting is absolutely terrific. The thing I kind of was impressed by the most is that there's a lot of times where one character is just monologuing at the other one, you know, either ranting or imploring or, you know, kind of airing everything. But it's kind of really interesting to watch what the other actor's doing at the same time. I thought the acting there was very subtle, watching their kind of different expressions as they react to what's being said to them. So you do get these very kind of big grandstanding moments. It's, you know, it's very kind of gets quite fiery, but at the same time, there's quite a lot of nuance and subtlety. I thought Zendaya was particularly excellent, especially in the more dramatic moments and very funny as well. Across the spectrum, she was outstanding. So yeah, I mean, I did find it quite exhausting, I have to say, by the end of it. I was kind of worn out by these two, which I guess is probably, you know, intentional, but yeah, very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, I found exactly the same. It's sensationally acted from both of them. but absolutely draining to watch. I kind of wished it had been maybe 15 minutes shorter, just because it is so exhausting and there literally are just the two characters. But some of John David Washington's rants, particularly about critics, which I did find quite amusing. I'd love to see what the review from the LA Times is going to be like, because he does talk about the Los Angeles Times and the critic from that, although, of course, that critic remains unnamed in the film. But I think anyone that sort of has any connection to the film industry as well will find it quite amusing from that point of view. It's a great depiction of an egotistical director and so many issues that are sort of involved these days with diversity. They really nail that brilliantly. But yeah, basically, it's just a brilliant two-hander. But as I say, I could have done with it being a little shorter just to be less exhausted by the end of it.
Yeah, I get that. It's interesting as well, because I really, really like this film a lot as well. I agree with both what you guys said, but it did get a very mixed reaction when the reviews kind of launched online. Do you guys have any thoughts on that? Like, I wonder, do you think because it's so much about critics, do you think some critics just took exception to some of the stuff he was saying? Because the way I read it, because Malcolm, he has many epic rants, but he has some epic rants about the reviews and the reviews he's expecting. And we kind of see in the film, as James said, the first review from the LA Times drops. I thought so much that was kind of more about him, you know, and his reaction. And we were supposed to think he was behaving a bit ridiculously at times. But I think maybe some people took exception and took that as the film saying critics can't do this and can't say that. And yeah, because I was surprised.
Really like being criticised, I think. So. I have to say, the bit where he's searching for his wallet to get his credit card to get behind the paywall of the LA Times so he can read the review was absolutely brilliant, because I know that reaction myself in terms of, you know, running around searching for your wallet and going ballistic because you can't find it. I was looking at that thinking, oh, that's exactly how I react. It's pretty embarrassing. But yeah, I mean, you could be right about the mixed reaction. It cuts very close to the bone, doesn't it, for the sort of critical community. And that's probably what makes it an interesting piece, I think.
Yeah, I think he made lots of valid points. I mean, he's just kind of saying, you know, critics should be a bit more thoughtful about the terms they use, really, and, you know, do their research and things like that. You know, it's kind of couched in good humour as well. It didn't sort of come across as kind of bitter, really, or mean-spirited. I thought they made a really good job of that. You know, same, it kind of reminded me of that scene in Ratatouille at the end, where the critic kind of critiques criticism. It was handled as successfully as that, really.
Yeah, because they do tackle a lot of big themes as well, don't they? I think they churn through many, like, huge topics in the film. I love the way that this kind of power dynamic keeps changing between them as you kind of learn more about the whole backstory of their sort of relationship and as more things come out. And there's always seems to be one who's got the upper hand. And yeah, I like that adds to the exhausting nature.
It looks absolutely beautiful as well. Oh, yeah. A real thing for kind of modern day contemporary black and white films. The location of this sort of kind of modernist house that they live in looks beautiful in black and white. I mean, that really added something, I thought, to the experience.
Yeah, I thought, it looked as lovely as Mank, and there's a couple of exterior scenes as well. I mean, they're really sort of poetic. More films should be in black and white. I don't know why we don't have so many these days. It's still there. We should do it.
Absolutely.
So that was Malcolm and Marie, which comes highly recommended by us, and that's on Netflix from this Friday, the 5th of February. Next up, it's the end of the world as Gerard Butler knows it, and he doesn't feel fine.
This is the fragment entering the lower atmosphere.
3, 2, 1, an impact.
What is the explosion?
It's a chunk of rock. Rocks don't explode.
Yeah, tell that to the dinosaurs.
The sky's on fire.
Come on, let's go.
With the largest fragment expected to hit in less than 24 hours, space agencies are expecting an extinction-level event.
That was Greenland. James, can you set this one up for us, please?
Yes. Gerard Butler, he plays John Garrity, who is a structural engineer, family man, living in Atlanta with his wife, Allison, played by Morena Baccarin, and his sort of young son, Nathan. At the beginning, he gets a message on his phone that effectively his family have been selected to sort of travel to this kind of undisclosed location to be effectively transported to a safe location. The reason being, there's a comet and its fragments of it are heading to the Earth, and those fragments are pretty big and they're going to start destroying huge parts of the planet. So clearly the government are gathering intelligent people together, those with skills such as his, being a sort of structural engineer. And really the film is the journey of the family to this location And the, let's just say it's a journey that doesn't go particularly smoothly.
Obviously, on the one hand, it sounds a bit Armageddon, but it's, for me, it definitely falls more into the sort of Deep Impact school of films. What did you guys think? But because obviously, if I'm honest, going into it, I had sort of lowish expectations, thinking like a kind of apocalyptic action movie starring Gerard Butler. I just didn't have the highest expectations, but I actually really quite enjoyed this film, and I found it was much more kind of dramatic and sort of character driven than I was expecting from this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was the same. I mean, looking at the trailer and the poster, I really wasn't expecting much from this. But yeah, I was kind of very pleasantly surprised to find how involved I got in this film. And it's, I mean, it's really quite stressful to watch in places. It gets quite harrowing. There's a few developments because they also have a seven-year-old child, and there's a few developments centered on him that, yeah, do kind of rattle your nerves as you're watching it. There's no kind of comic relief characters. I mean, you do get classic disaster movie dialogue like, go, 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 and cars driving through metal fences, but there's no kind of dogs leaping away from fireballs, no comic relief characters. I mean, there's no real humour in it at all, really. You know, there's no kind of zingers or one-liners to let the audience off the hook. I mean, it is just this very stressful journey with quite a surprising amount of realistic detail as well, like all the phone messages, the wristbands that you need, and forgetting certain key items in their luggage. I mean, it's all very relatable. So yeah, I was very surprised by it, and I don't know if I'd say enjoyed, because like Malcolm and Marie, it left me pretty worn out, but I was impressed by it there.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Although Armageddon and Deep Impact are the kind of obvious touchstones from 20 or so years ago, it's very different to those. There aren't any sort of real superhero type characters in this that are going to save the planet. It's a much more realistic story as to what might happen if something crazy like a comet starts heading to the Earth, the chaos that we'll all find ourselves in. And I think the director, Rick Roman Moore, gets that pretty well, I think. There's enough action in here, but you don't feel like it's sort of fantastical. There's no Bruce Willis going into space with Aerosmith on the soundtrack, so we're safe there, I think.
Yeah, I actually thought it was a pretty good performance from Gerard Butler as well, because, again, as you say, it sort of moves away from that typical action man type performance. You know, yeah, he's not really doing any sort of superheroics or anything like that. And I thought he was pretty good.
He's quite a flawed character as well, isn't he? Yeah. In various ways, you do kind of sympathise with him and the whole family. I won't have a word said against San Andreas, but this is very much the anti-San Andreas, you know, just focusing on this small family in the face of this global crisis.
You get a few set pieces, don't you, as well? And I actually thought, again, one thing that perhaps slightly lets the film down a tiny bit is some of the CGI is on the sort of ropier side in places. But as that's quite a minimal part of the film, and as it is so sort of much more kind of focused on the characters and the tension, I found that I just kind of forgave it that.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it's, you know, the biggest budget for VFX.
And watching on a small screen as well, that's less noticeable, I think.
Talking of the sort of situations we're in at the moment, watching films at home, I couldn't actually, for some reason, get the link to work on my television, so I had to watch it on my iPad, which is really not the way to watch this film. I do not advise anyone watching Greenland on an iPad. Please watch it on the biggest screen possible, to the point where I was even having to hold the screen open with my fingertips at one point because it kept going small. It was a little bit stressful from that point of view, but not as stressful as Gerard's journey through the film.
So on that note, that again, it's another recommendation, I'd say, isn't it, from all of us? But again, with kind of caution that it's going to be a bit of a stressful evening. And so that's Greenland, which is on Amazon Prime Video, again, from Friday, 5th of February. And yeah, try and watch it on your TV if you can, as opposed to your iPad. Now it's on to something a little less apocalyptic with this.
Look at you, my beauties. You are beautiful. You are beautiful. But you're the best.
This is the one we've all been waiting for, folks. The Calvin Horn Ram judging.
Fine Ram, all right?
He's gonna be a busy boy, I reckon.
What do you mean?
Okay, the Grimason brothers find themselves the last two standing yet again. And Les Grimason is the winner.
You little ripper!
So that was Rams. Matthew, can you set up Rams for us, please?
Yes, so this is an Australian remake of a 2015 Icelandic drama set in Western Australia. And it focuses on two brothers, Colin, played by Sam Neill, and Les, played by Michael Caton. These are two farmers who have quite a tricky, estranged, basically, relationship. And things are kind of toddling along quite nicely, but then there's this an outbreak of disease, which means that all the sheep in the area have to be put down. So we're kind of dealing with an epidemic, so it kind of makes it quite topical. But both brothers dig their heels in over this, one in a kind of fairly sly way, but the other one in a not so sly way, and he goes a little bit further off the rails. And so we follow the relationship between these two brothers, how they deal with the fallout from this crisis. It's kind of pitched as a comedy drama, but there are laughs in it, but it's quite dark as well. It kind of goes to quite gritty places, you know, more than I was expecting. It's not feel good, especially. It's quite quite downbeat, you know. It does kind of take this problem seriously. But you do have these strong performances, particularly from Sam Neill. I mean, this is probably the best we've seen him in a lead role for quite a while. And you get Miranda Richardson as well as a doctor who kind of acts as a sort of a go-between the two brothers. She gets involved.
Yeah, I agree with what you said there, because I actually hadn't seen the 2015 Icelandic film.
No, me neither.
I went in kind of not really knowing a huge amount about it and what was going to happen. But yeah, it definitely was like less comedic than I was expecting, and definitely more melancholy and more serious. But there was still something about it that I just really warmed to, like it had a really kind of like nice sense of place that you really sort of bought into that community in that town.
Yeah.
And just that kind of lifestyle of these kind of rare breed sheep farmers. And I found it sort of stayed with me quite a lot since as well. Sam Neill, I thought, was great. Just in it. And again, it's one of those, it's not a showy performance. It's quite a kind of grumpy, gruff kind of performance, but paired back at the same time. Again, like he's not kind of playing it for laughs. But I really enjoyed it. What did you think, James?
No, absolutely. I mean, I have to say with Sam Neill, it did remind me slightly of his character in Hunt for the Wilder People. Mm. Probably the last great thing we've seen him in. I feel like, you know, there, people often talk about actors being a kind of national institution. I think Sam Neill now needs to be promoted to a global institution, because he's just knocking it out of the park again and again. I mean, I'm sure we're all excited to see him back as Alan Grant, next year now in Jurassic World Dominion.
Oh, yeah.
He's just at that age now where all his choices are really, really good. And yeah, he's superb in this. Although you're right, there isn't a lot of humour in it. It does bubble along underneath. There's some good sheep humour as well, I'll say, at certain points without giving too much away. Yeah, I hadn't seen the original movie either. And I only really knew it was about sort of two kind of feuding brothers. And this just seems like a perfect remake. It's not sort of been, let's say, transposed to Hollywood or something and done a version there. I would imagine, not having seen the original, it's kind of kept its authenticity, it feels like.
Yeah. And it also feels very specific to that place as well. You could almost imagine it being like that epidemic that we see in the film being a real thing. Felt very believable. But yeah, I don't know what the exact story of the other one was, but it felt just felt like it really suited that sort of Australian setting.
Yeah, and they deal with the bushfires as well, which is obviously an ongoing concern. They deal with that in quite a realistic, troubling fashion.
I would recommend it. I definitely enjoyed it.
Again, it's been a pretty strong week so far. Another recommendation, another thumbs up. Yeah, that was Rams, which is on digital HD from, again, Friday, 5th of February. And now, onto this one.
I have a picture in my head of a place. I don't know if it's real, but it has a feeling, and the feeling's real.
James, what's Bliss about?
So Bliss, first of all, one of these films that's very difficult to talk about without giving too much away. Yeah. So I'm going to try not to give too much away here. But we have Owen Wilson plays Greg. He's a kind of divorced office drone, we could say. He's sort of somewhat estranged from his daughter. The world he lives in is pretty drab, really. And kind of early on, he has this kind of altercation with his boss in his boss's office. And the guy dies and he sort of hits his head on a desk. And he sort of flees the building and runs into this bar close by to sort of hide, not really knowing what on earth's happening. He runs into Isabel, played by Salma Hayek, who's this sort of homeless, kind of heavily made up, odd looking character, really, who basically says to him, "You're real. You and I are the only real people in this world." And of course, he's got no idea what she's talking about. And she sort of claims that they're living in some form of a simulation. After that, Greg tags along with her. And that's probably about the point I should stop, really, I feel like. There's something to do with crystals, which we won't go into too much. It's, of course, red pill, blue pill, that kind of thing, if that reference means anything to anyone, which it should do. That might give something away. But yeah, that's where I think we should leave it.
I agree. And actually, I would add to that, if you haven't watched the trailer yet, perhaps don't watch it because the trailer does give away much more than you have done. Did you guys actually like it? What did you think, Matthew?
Yeah, I like the originality of it and the unpredictability of it, especially in the early going when it's kind of like being trapped in a sort of a waking dream, those first few scenes, particularly the way he deals with the situation to do with his boss. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. And then there's another scene later on in a roller skating rink. It's not a kind of flashy movie, but there's some very clever special effects that they employ. Yeah, I thought it kind of trundled along quite intriguingly, but I felt like it never really kind of got to a kind of crucial dramatic point or really fleshed out some of its ideas. Wilson and Hayek are, you know, very, very watchable. I thought they had a nice chemistry together, but I felt like there was more to be said about their characters. I felt like it didn't quite dig deep enough beneath the surface. I did find the ending a little bit unsatisfying. I felt it just sort of petered out. But for the most part, I mean, compelling, certainly.
Did you like it, James?
I was a little disappointed. I mean, we should say that the director's Mike Cahill, who did a film called Another Earth, and that was about a sort of parallel Earth, if anyone remembers this, which was, you know, quite a fascinating idea. And he obviously has these great concepts, and that film worked very well, Another Earth, but I didn't feel like the concept here, great though the setup was, as I just described, I didn't feel like it fully saw it through to the end. As Matthew was saying, the ending's a little disappointing, and the more complex it got, the more unsatisfying I found it, basically.
Yeah, I don't know if it helped me that I went in with slightly lowered expectations, because in Total Film, it's got a 2-star review, so I kind of went in kind of tempered, not really expecting too much. I felt similar to Matthew in that, like, I found it kind of intriguing enough and quite watchable. Enjoyed those two. And it's, as we'll kind of discuss a bit more later probably as well, it's a sort of perennial idea, this, you know, like, are you in a simulation type thing. But the whole thing just wasn't very substantial. Like, it felt like maybe it would have been better suited to being, say, like one episode of like an anthology like Black Mirror or something, where perhaps your standards are a bit lower because, you know, it's just a one-hour thing in the middle of a series where you're sort of trying out all different things. Whereas some of the way that James mentioned crystals as one thing, which I think that's fair to discuss because that's not really spoilery. And Salma Hayek's character, you know, introduces Owen Wilson to these crystals, which, you know, again, do we take as an analogy for drugs or whatever, which opens up kind of things in this world, you know, that kind of to show it's a simulation. It gives them certain powers within this world that she's claiming is a simulation. But it doesn't really feel like a fleshed out sort of explained idea. It just feels a bit like a random token kind of thing. And then as things develop later, I felt it often just felt a bit quite sketchy, this world, like it wasn't necessarily like the most rigorously sort of, you know, crafted and put together. So that kind of, you know, let it down a bit for me. But then, as someone who enjoys like Black Mirror and things like that, yeah, I did find it watchable and found it quite intriguing. And there's some fun ideas in there.
Yeah, but the idea visualizer, I liked all those little flourishes. Yeah, and the roller skate scene. But yeah, it felt maybe a little bit less than the sum of its parts. Mm.
Too many ideas that didn't quite gel.
So that was Bliss, if you want to give that a go. It's on Amazon Prime Video from Friday, 5th of February. Our final film today is actually quite an appropriate follow-up to that. It's a documentary and it's all about simulation theory. Is our reality just a fabrication?
You can't mention simulation theory without mentioning the Matrix movies.
People were going crazy over it. The Matrix was real.
We are living in a simulation. We are being inhabited by some sort of player.
It's a game.
A world without rules and controls.
What's the point of all this?
Everyone is fake.
I am not a body at all. I am the code. I am a string of numbers constantly replicating in some vibration.
None of this is real.
I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see.
That was A Glitch in the Matrix. Matthew, could you tell us what this is about, please?
In the words of one F. Mercury, this asks two big questions. Is this the real life or is this just fantasy? This is a new documentary from Rodney Asher, who's probably best known for Room 237, which dealt with all the conspiracy theories and possible hidden messages surrounding The Shining. And this kind of complements this in a way. As you said, it's all about simulation theory. is the real world real, or are we living in the Matrix? And there's quite a lot of references to the Matrix in this, but it's kind of a lot more wide ranging than that. It kind of goes all the way back to Plato's philosophies, and then it moves on to Philip K. Dick. And there's lots of interviews with people who do buy into this simulation theory. And then there's, it kind of moves on to some real life cases. Particularly of note is the Matrix defense, where a defendant says they committed a crime because they believe they're inside the Matrix. And there's a particular reference to someone called Joshua Cook, whose defense argued that this as justification for him killing his adopted parents. So it does have some very kind of real world connections as it discusses all this. And visually, it's quite jazzy as well. There's lots of computer graphics. A lot of the interviewees appear, gone overboard with the Snapchat filters. As you see, their digital avatars. It's kind of, it's a talking head documentary, but the talking heads will often appear like a kind of fantastical chimera. So that kind of gives it a bit of visual interest.
But did you actually like it, Matthew?
Yeah, I sort of found it similar to Room 237 in that I started to find it a little bit tenuous as the more it went on. But at the same time, you can't really watch it without thinking, is this all real? You know, what is the truth of simulation theory? There's a bit where a guy says he believes it's a simulation because he pictures things like when he's out for a walk, he thinks, oh, I'm going to see an orange fish. Mm. Then he turns the corner 10 minutes later and there's an orange fish in a restaurant sign. So it can't help but sort of play on your fears and fantasies of what is actually real.
I could see it doing a lot of people's heads in. They kind of even mention that in the film, don't they? They kind of say that this could be a really bad thing, that you're putting this out into the world. What did you think, James?
I mean, I was dying to see this film because I was a huge fan of Room 237. There were so many great characters in Room 237. I mean, The Shining's a film, you know, many of us know, and I'd never thought of it in those terms. And that was really a film about obsession. And I suppose this film is about obsession too, in a different way. So you can definitely see they were made by the same filmmaker. I wasn't as engaged with this film as I was with Room 237. I found the digital avatars thing really distracting, I have to say, because you do get to see some people who are espousing these theories in their normal human form. And that was interesting because you could see their faces, you could see what they're like. But these guys, you know, disguised by these avatars, it was just odd. And I didn't really connect with the people then as much, I found. So I don't know why they did that, whether they were worried that they were going to be lampooned or something. And although anyone dressed as a digital avatar is effectively being lampooned anyway. But yeah, I found that odd. I mean, Matthew mentioned the Joshua Cook aspect. And that sort of comes in the latter third of the film. And I thought that was fascinating. And that was very different. And that was very disturbing. So there were elements that I really, really liked, but I didn't quite love it as much as Room 237, as much as I'd hoped anyway.
Yeah. I thought it was a shame that, you know, given all the folk, they keep coming back to the Matrix and there's lots of clips from the Matrix, but they don't really talk to anyone from the Matrix. I would like to have had their kind of slant on simulation theory, you know, as a kind of a counter to what some of the other people are saying. If you're a fan of The Matrix, you'll definitely want to see this, but at the same time, perhaps doesn't go quite as deep as you might expect or want.
Yeah.
I mean, this might sound sort of nitpicking, but I don't know this for sure, so it might be wrong, but it seemed like the clips were all very, very brief, not only of The Matrix, but everything else that they show. It was all done clearly on a budget under the kind of, I think it's called fair use, where they can sort of use clips to very briefly to illustrate points. But I found that quite distracting in a way. It was like little montages of clips that didn't really say a great deal. I mean, they might mention Star Wars and you get a clip from Star Wars for 2 seconds and then you're onto something else before, of course, legally they'd have to pay for, you know, the So I don't know why, but that sort of distracted me as well. But, you know, you mentioned the computer graphics. I guess they put their money into sort of realizing certain elements that are being talked about with that. I mean, I thought the best stuff was the Philip K. Dick footage from in France, isn't it, in about 1977. He's giving a talk, basically, and he starts talking about all this stuff. And obviously, we all know him as the guy who wrote the story that Blade Runner became and, you know, Total Recall and everything. He's obviously been hugely influential on movie sci-fi. But I don't know a huge amount about him, so it was fascinating to see his contribution, let's say, to that discussion.
Also, the guy who'd kind of edited the exegesis that he wrote. I love Philip K. Dick anyway, so just, I love that side of it. I must admit, I enjoyed this slightly more than you guys, in that I fully take on that. Obviously, it would have been nice to have some input from the Matrix people, but I can see why some people wouldn't like this. But I just loved those weird avatars they had, like right from the beginning. I just thought it just made it so weird and freaky. It just obviously kind of plays into the whole theme. There is something sort of disturbing about it in a way, because some of them are just quite grotesque looking. But then there's something just really funny about the way they were just talking normally, and then they would occasionally do things like scratch their faces or pause or stumble over their words or something. But they had these really weird, like, avatars had, like, you know, a big robot type helmet with a bit of brain showing and stuff like that. And just to sort of see them just sort of sitting there in a room talking normally, I just found that sort of fascinating. And I actually liked the way you got so many different little clips, and obviously, unsurprisingly, there's a lot of like Elon Musk in there, and there's kind of little mini animated interludes where they're kind of animating some of the sort of concepts that the people are describing, which I thought worked really well. And yeah, I just thought it was obviously messes with your head, but I did find it really enjoyable.
And kind of
why it's been scheduled against Bliss as well. Is this some sort of, someone's got together and thought, you know, are we now in some sort of scheduling computer program? I'm not sure.
Weird. Yeah, that's a weird glitch. All the films this week kind of resonate with our current situation in one way or another, and particularly this one. I think this will kind of generate quite a lot of interest, because I'm sure more people will want to subscribe to this idea of the simulation theory given the current global situation. So I think that did give it a bit more resonance.
It was nice to see there was a lot of reference to video games as well. I mean, you see clips from, I think, Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption and all these kind of things. And they don't always get, you know, included in sort of these discussions as a popular culture. So I thought that was quite interesting that, you know, that's very much a part of it, I suppose, people immersing themselves in video game culture. And I thought that aspect of the film worked well.
No, I agree. Yeah. And it does raise that sort of disturbing question as well, of like certain people talking about, you know, the kind of acts that people commit in video games, and, you know, certain people saying they would just do it in real life if they, you know, knew it was just a video game. And it's raises all sorts of weird disturbing questions. And I also found there was just something fascinating about just a lot of these oddball characters. One of the talking heads avatar people says that they live by a 12-day week or something. This weird spreadsheet how they divide up their life. Like, I wasn't particularly up on simulation theory before, so I found it quite a fascinating, sometimes disturbing glimpse into that kind of world and sort of thinking, which I didn't really know too much about. And I'm going to try not to think about it too much, because, you know, I don't really want to sort of fall down that rabbit hole. But ultimately, I kind of think my life's kind of probably too boring to be a simulation theory. Surely.
That's the way you burst out of the incubator and you've got all those little
plugs. It's coming. I'm definitely going to look for an orange fish. Next time I go out, I'm going to see how long it takes me to find an orange fish. I'm so
going to do that. If I see an orange fish today, I will freak out, though. Then there's something.
Perhaps we're in the same simulation.
What if you guys are just non-player characters in my simulation, though?
Oh. It's possible.
I would like it to be more like Jumanji, if it was, to be honest. Kind of fun.
One other thing I will say about the film is it definitely makes you want to revisit The Matrix as well. It definitely did with me. I was like, right, yeah, I've got to rewatch that soon. It's been a bit too long.
But interesting, there's obviously a fourth Matrix coming. There was no mention of that in the film. I guess they don't really know much about the film, so they can't talk about it. But, you know, all this stuff, it feels like when that film is finally released, it's going to come back again, I guess. It's going to be a popular topic.
Yeah.
The defining theme of 2021, maybe. Anyway, if that sounds interesting to you, that's A Glitch in the Matrix, and it's released again on Friday, 5th of February, on VOD platforms and Dogwoof on Demand. So it's also getting a DVD and Blu-ray release in May. So that's pretty much it for today. There's just enough time left for me to say there's actually a new issue of Total Film Magazine out this week. If you're a subscriber, you'll have your copy already. And on the cover, we've got The Little Things, starring Denzel Washington, Rami Malek and Jared Leto. And inside are Jamie Graham chats to all those guys and writer-director John Lee Hancock about this throwback thriller, which kind of evokes the 90s heyday of serial killer films. James, you've actually seen the film, haven't you? And you really liked it.
I did. It does exactly what you said. It sort of evokes those 90s grungy serial killer films. Can't say any more than that, but get Total Film, read about it, then go and see the film.
And also, if you pick up the mag, James, you've also done a big feature on Coming to America. Who did you speak to for that?
I spoke to the great Craig Brewer, who directed the film, and three of the essential cast, Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall and Leslie Jones.
So that's a great fun feature. I highly recommend you checking it out. And I also had a few interviews. I really enjoyed this issue. I spoke to Daniel Kaluuya about Judas and the Black Messiah, Tom Holland about his new film with the Russo brothers, Cherry. And I also have a big career chat with Olivia Colman, head of release of The Father, And that was great fun as well. So all that and much more in the new issue, which is on sale from tomorrow, Friday the 5th of February. Loads of exciting stuff happening on Friday the 5th of February. That's it for us this week. So just time left for us to say goodbye. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.